Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. The county's Office of Education has announced it will hold four hearings in East County to get public input on that controversial redistricting plan proposed by the Grossmont Union High School District that some are calling gerrymandering. We'll have details on today's show on how you can have your voice heard. On our Capitol Report, we'll have the latest on the presidential primaries, including Super Tuesday results, growing criticism of Donald Trump from prominent Republicans, and some ethics questions facing the Clinton campaign on the Democratic side. There's also new evidence of a link between Zika virus and a paralyzing condition. Then on Jobs Talk, hear about a bill by Senator Ben Wesso to encourage employers to hire at-risk youths. We'll have news about a photographer attacked at a Donald Trump rally and about threats made by Trump against the media's First Amendment rights. On Green Scene, we'll have results of our own investigation into a third straight year of failure at the Ocotillo Wind Facility to produce the power promised. Then on our agricultural report, hear about a new City of San Diego law to encourage urban agriculture. On Destination East County, we'll have lots of fun festivals and events for you, from a spring carnival at a lake to night hikes, garden tours, stargazing, St. Patrick's Day events, egg hunts, theatrical performances, and concerts. On sports, get details on the Aztecs' latest victory. And finally, in a Best of East County segment, we will take you on the road to Julian, East County's historic gold rush town. So stay tuned for all of these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is Miriam Raftery with an important announcement for parents of high school students and future students in the Grossmont Union High School District. In response to concerns raised about Grossmont's very controversial redistricting plans, the County Committee on School District Organization has announced it will hold four hearings in East County to get public input on Grossmont's proposed shift to elect governing board trustees by districts. The Grossmont Board voted 4-1 to adopt a controversial map and seek a waiver of a public vote on redistricting, despite opposition from members of the public who spoke. Some have alleged gerrymandering to oust a dissenting board member, Priscilla Schreiber, and to break up a vocal minority voting bloc, the Iraqi Chaldeans, as we previously reported. In fact, our article was cited in the county committee's discussion, and board members made clear that they will be asking the Grossmont District representatives for explanations at upcoming hearings. The public can testify at these meetings and also submit written comments up until April 7th. The county's committee is expected to vote to approve or disapprove the district's request at its April 13th meeting. Now, the upcoming hearings, where you can speak if you arrive early and get a speaker card, will be held as follows. On March 17th at 6 p.m. in La Mesa at the La Mesa Spring Valley School District Boardroom. On March 28th at 6 p.m. in El Cajon at the East County Regional Education Center. On April 5th at 6 p.m. in the Hamul Intermediate School Library in Hamul. And on April 11th at 6 p.m. in the Lakeside Union School District Administration Center in Lakeside. East County Magazine has contacted the County Board of Education to ask why it didn't schedule a hearing in Alpine, which is the community that has voiced the most concerns over losing its vocal supporter of an Alpine high school through redistricting. If you share that concern, you can contact the County Board at 858-292-3515. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery with a wrap-up on Super Tuesday results. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and billionaire businessman Donald Trump strengthened their positions as frontrunners in the Democratic and Republican presidential race, each scoring wins in 7 out of 12 states that held primaries or caucuses on Super Tuesday this week. Vermont Democratic Senator Bernie Sanders, however, also picked up 4 key wins in Colorado, Minnesota, his home state of Vermont, and Oklahoma, a conservative state, leaving the door open for an upset on the Democratic side, but only if he can produce landslides across the West and populous states that have not yet cast ballots. Texas Senator Ted Cruz picked up 3 wins to continue his challenge to Trump, while Florida Senator Marco Rubio, also a Republican, won his first primary victory to keep his candidacy tenuously alive. Currently, Clinton has 1,055 delegates amassed to Sanders' 418, according to CNN. It takes 2,383 delegates to win the Democratic nomination, so she's about halfway there. Clinton swept the South, picking up Texas, Georgia, Alabama, Arkansas, Virginia, and Tennessee, as well as Massachusetts, a liberal plum in the Northeast. Clinton did particularly well with black voters in the South. But the question remains whether her lead can hold in areas with larger white or Hispanic populations in upcoming primary states. Sanders, though viewed by many analysts as somewhat of a long shot, surprised many with his wins in conservative Oklahoma and Colorado, both swing states. He is motivating young people and drawing huge crowds that could bode well for Democratic voter turnout if he wins. Both Sanders and Trump have defied expectations repeatedly, doing better than the pundits have predicted. On the Republican side, Trump trounced his opponents in all of the southern states, voting on Tuesday except Texas. He also won in Massachusetts and Vermont. Cruz won his home state of Texas along with Oklahoma and Alaska's Republican caucus. Rubio scored his first win in Minnesota. According to CNN estimates, Trump now has a total of 315 delegates, while Cruz has 205 and Rubio 107. In the Republican primary, just 1,237 delegates are needed to win. 2 other GOP candidates, neurosurgeon Ben Carson and Ohio Governor John Kasich, still remain in the race, but they have not won a single primary. Meanwhile, a new CNN poll shows that both Clinton and Sanders would beat Trump in a general election, but that Clinton would lose to Rubio or Cruz. Those results may give voters in upcoming states pause to reassess the party frontrunners. According to the national poll, Sanders would beat Trump by 53% to 45%, and Clinton would beat Trump by 52% to 44%. But against Cruz, Sanders would win by a strong 57 to 40% margin, whereas Cruz would beat Clinton by a slim 49 to 48% margin. Paired against Rubio, Sanders would win by a solid 53% to 45% margin, while Rubio would get 50% to eke out Clinton's 47% if the national election were held today, according to that CNN poll. Trump's string of victories has many Republican leaders, quote, desperate, unquote, to halt his candidacy, according to an Associated Press headline after Super Tuesday. Some prominent Republicans are speaking out to denounce Trump for refusing to distance himself from white supremacist Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke, who is backing Trump's campaign. Republican Senate Leader Mitch McConnell stated, Senate Republicans condemn David Duke, the KKK, and his racism. Noting Trump's seeming ambivalence about David Duke and the KKK, let me make it perfectly clear, he went on. This is not the view of Republicans who have been elected to the United States Senate, and I condemn his views in the most forceful way. House Speaker Paul Ryan also spoke out, stating if a person wants to be the nominee of the Republican Party, there can be no evasion and no games. They must reject any group or cause that is built on bigotry. Conservative commentator Joe Scarborough called Trump's action disqualifying after Trump claimed he didn't know who David Duke was and told the news interviewer he would have to research the KKK further. Former Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney has also spoken out, calling Trump unfit for the presidency. Trump picked up the endorsement, however, of New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who dropped his own presidential bid. That prompted 6 newspapers owned by Gannett News Service in New Jersey to publish editorials calling on Christie to resign from the governorship, stating of their prior endorsement of his candidacy, boy, were we wrong. Many party insiders worry that Trump, whose brash style, racist remarks, and insults targeting women, Latinos, blacks, Jews, Muslims, and the disabled, could prove destructive for the Republican Party overall if Republican voters stay home or cross party lines to vote Democratic or third party. Republicans' chances of stopping Trump may hinge on a brokered convention if he does not win a clear majority of delegates. There is talk of releasing pledged delegates on the convention floor to vote for other candidates, though it's far from clear whether Trump loyalists would abandon their candidate even then. Some have talked about a party heavyweight, such as former presidential nominee Mitt Romney, jumping into the fray as an alternative that more delegates might rally around. There is also a potential for a third-party run. Independent Jesse Ventura, the former world wrestling champion and ex-Minnesota governor, announced this week that he will launch an independent run for the presidency if the contest boils down to Trump versus Clinton. The ever-flamboyant Ventura told the Daily Beast, "See, I'm an independent and I despise the two parties." Speaking as if he was prepared to tackle someone, he went on, "I love what Trump's doing to the Republicans. He's got them in complete disarray. In fact, it looks like a World Wrestling Federation enterprise when you watch their debates," he concluded. In most recent elections, the presidential nominees have been decided long before voters in California ever head to the polls. But this year, if the primaries are not yet sewn up, would Californians cast votes on June 7th? California, with 546 Democratic delegates and 172 Republican delegates, that's more than any state in the nation, could prove a kingmaker in either or possibly both political parties. After Hillary Clinton's strong showing in the Super Tuesday primary, she is the front-runner in the Democratic presidential primary. But several revelations this week raise troubling questions for Clinton supporters regarding the integrity of Clinton and her campaign. First, the U.S. Justice Department has granted immunity to Brian Pagliano, the staffer who set up a private email server in Clinton's home, as the investigation into allegations over classified emails continues, The Washington Post reports. What does the staffer know, and could Clinton possibly face indictment? Second, the Clinton campaign and super PACs supporting Clinton have paid pundits who have appeared on major TV news shows. They were presented as neutral analysts, all touting Clinton's candidacy and downplaying the electability of her opponent, Bernie Sanders. TV networks failed to disclose those financial ties, which is a clear violation of journalistic ethics, The Intercept revealed in an investigative report. Third, former President Bill Clinton has drawn criticism for holding a rally for his wife outside a Massachusetts polling place on Super Tuesday, using a megaphone for amplification, and even entering two other polling places on Election Day. Massachusetts law prohibits electioneering within 150 feet of polling places, the Boston Globe reports. No charges were filed despite videos of these activities, although the Secretary of State there did send the Clinton campaign a reminder of the state's rules. The federal investigation of emails sent and received by Clinton on her home server while she was Secretary of State poses the most serious concern for the party, raising the specter of a candidate winning the Democratic nomination only to potentially face criminal charges during a general election or even a possible conviction after being elected president. Of course, the Justice Department could also clear Clinton of wrongdoing, but the mere spectacle of a presidential candidate being interrogated could influence some voters. If the protected staffer becomes a whistleblower or felony indictment occurs before the general election in November, does the party have a plan B? Paying pundits to pose as neutral political analysts when in fact they were propagandists seeking to sway voters, some with the clear knowledge of the media, is a deceptive tactic bound to anger many voters as well. Will it backfire as news spreads through social media, a growing alternative source of news for voters who are distrustful of mainstream media, and in this case, for obviously good reason? The Clintons are seasoned campaigners and surely know that picking up a bullhorn outside a polling place or shaking hands inside the polling place where votes are being cast would be construed as violating election laws and ethics. The tactic is being denounced by supporters of Senator Bernie Sanders, who perceive the incident as arrogance on the part of the Clinton campaign and arguably an effort to suppress votes for Sanders. Whether these controversies will impact enough voters to turn the tide in the upcoming primary states, however, remains to be seen. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Ed Barena with a health report on East County Magazine. The Zika virus has recently been suspected of causing Guillain-Barré syndrome, a rare neurological disorder. It can leave patients partially paralyzed, also causing breathing problems in severe cases after the patient's immune system attacks nerve cells, according to the Centers for Disease Control. Now results of a study published in the medical journal The Lancet confirms that nearly all of the blood samples from 42 Guillain-Barré patients in French Polynesia in the South Pacific 2 years ago also tested positive for Zika virus. The neurological problems developed about 6 days after patients were infected with Zika. Scientists called the findings compelling, the BBC reports. Based on the data from French Polynesia, medical experts estimate that about 1 in every 4,000 people who contract Zika could develop Guillain-Barré. So countries at risk of major Zika outbreaks are being advised to prepare for some Guillain-Barré cases as well. A Zika outbreak in Brazil has also been suspected of causing several thousand cases of babies born with microcephaly, a normally rare condition that causes small skulls and brain damage. Thus far, microcephaly cases have not been found in other nations with severe Zika outbreaks, however, so it's possible the Brazilian cases could have another cause, such as chemical larvicides sprayed into water. The World Health Organization has declared Zika a worldwide emergency. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control have issued travel warnings for virtually all of South and Central America, as well as the Caribbean and some portions of Africa. Mexico has also had locally transmitted Zika cases, but not in the northern portion near our border. Two species of mosquitoes that carry Zika have been found in San Diego, but thus far the only case of Zika virus here was in a woman who contracted the illness while traveling in Colombia.
Welcome to East County Magazine Show's Jobs Talk, bringing you news about great jobs, job training opportunities, and growing our regional economy.
This is Leon Thompson, guest hosting East County Magazine's Jobs Talk. State Senator Ben Hueso, a Democrat representing San Diego and the southern portion of East County, has introduced Senate Bill 1216 to establish a business tax credit for employers who hire high-risk youth. The credit would apply only to jobs provided for young people ages 18 to 25 who have been convicted of a crime and completed a work readiness program through a qualified job training provider. Senator Hueso states, "We need to open the doors of opportunity for our high-risk youth by helping them enter the workforce." Senate Bill 1216 will incentivize California businesses and help our high-risk youth become fully employed, functional members of society. Research indicates that the first 14 months are critical for a convicted felon's transition back into the community, and lack of state help with job placement or continued rehabilitation increases the chances that they will reoffend. Rob Chavez, CEO of Urban Core in San Diego County, a youth job training and high school education program, says, "For young people who have made mistakes and paid their debt to society, one of the last hurdles is re-entry into the workforce. It's hard enough being a job seeker. Having a prior conviction can be debilitating when job hunting with little to no real-world working experience." He adds, "We believe in second chances. SB 1216 rewards employers who invest in the future of our community by investing in second chances for youth." The measure is also backed by Dr. Randy Ward, San Diego County Superintendent of Schools. The superintendent states, "We always tell the students in our juvenile court and community schools that no matter what race they are or what neighborhood they come from or what their past behavior was, they have the ability to succeed in school and beyond. SB 1216 represents a chance to ensure that is the case by removing some of the barriers faced by students who are looking for every opportunity to transition into productive adults."
A Time magazine photographer was attacked by Secret Service agents at a Donald Trump rally on Monday. According to CNN, the photographer, Chris Morris, was attempting to leave the media pen to photograph a Black Lives Matter protest that had erupted when a Secret Service agent placed two hands on his neck and slammed him to the ground. The attack was captured on video and posted on social media by an attendee of the rally. Time magazine reported on the incident on their website, posting several videos, including one where Morris is swearing at the agent just before the attack. Another video shows Morris kicking the agent as he is pinned down to the ground and putting his hands on the agent's neck. Morris reportedly did this to demonstrate the chokehold he had just experienced, according to the article, which was written by Time staff. The Secret Service has indicated it will issue a statement after investigating the facts. Meanwhile, Trump campaign spokeswoman Hope Hicks requested that all questions be directed to law enforcement. Morris was not harmed and says he does not plan to press charges. Last Friday, Trump blasted media outlets such as the New York Times and Washington Post for their coverage of his campaign and threatened to roll back First Amendment freedoms of the press if elected. "With me, they're not protected because I'm not like other people," he stated at a rally in Texas. "We're going to open up those libel laws, folks, and we're going to have people sue you like you've never been sued before." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Liz Alpert.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
Welcome to East County Magazine Show's Jobs Talk, bringing you news about great jobs, job training opportunities, and growing our regional economy. This is Miriam Raftery with a green seam report, or in this case, a not-so-green report. The numbers are in, and for the third straight year, the Ocotillo Wind Energy Facility has fallen far short of the 34% capacity factor that Pattern Energy predicted the project would generate when it applied for lucrative federal subsidies. In 2015, the Ocotillo project generated just 23% of capacity. And in 2014, it hit 26%. And back in 2013, when it was offline 2 months for throwing off a multi-ton blade, it produced a scant 16%. We're not surprised at East County Magazine about the dismal results last year, once again, since our award-winning 2014 investigative article titled "Was It Fraud?" included forecasts by an international wind expert, Nicholas Bocard, who predicted back in 2013 that the project would be a failure. He suggested the federal government had grounds for a False Claims Act suit against Pattern Energy. We again raised questions about the project's viability in a second story last year. In its third year of dismal performance last year, the Ocotillo Wind Project reached the predicted 34% capacity forecast in just 3 months, April, May, and July, according to data from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. The year before, it hit capacity in just 3 months, and in 2013, just 1 month. We brought our findings, which included Bocard's damning conclusion and independent analysis of two other experts, to the attention of three members of Congress. Now, we contacted Congressman Juan Vargas, Congressman Daryl Issa, and then Congressman Bob Filner back in early 2014. Congressman Filner raised doubts in a letter sent to the Secretary of the Treasury, Timothy Geithner. He suggested that funding be halted before construction was completed, noting that the project posed potential to be a scandal worse than Solyndra, according to his handwritten note in the margin. Congressman Issa's offices were contacted, but he failed to respond to multiple inquiries. Congressman Vargas' staff told us that he reached out to the Department of Energy, but nothing has been done to take action on the fraud allegations. Pattern, asked for comment in both 2014 and 2015, never responded. The project is far from benign. It bulldozed about 12,000 acres of desert on public Bureau of Land Management land that shares a 5-mile border with the Anza Borrego Desert State Park. Multiple tribes also objected to destruction of sacred sites. Residents of Ocotillo, surrounded on three sides by the turbines, claim to have suffered health problems related to dust, sleep disruption, noise, and flashing red lights, and exposure to toxic chemicals dumped on the desert that later flooded their town. They also complain of loss of property values, destruction of pristine desert views, and a peaceful lifestyle, as we documented in many stories before the project was built and after. Ocotillo Wind was one of the first projects pushed forward under new fast-tracking projects for massive green energy projects. Residents, including an engineer, raised serious doubts about the project's viability as well as its predicted negative impacts, but their concerns fell on deaf ears as the federal government, aided by local and state officials, who failed to properly investigate concerns, pushed through the project without appropriate scrutiny of its negative impacts, nor even its ability to produce the wind power promised. To residents of Ocotillo, surrounded by over 100 wind turbines whirling in their community, each taller than a 50-story building at 500 feet high, the only thing green about the Ocotillo Wind Energy Facility now appears to be the money pocketed by the developer.
How you gonna keep 'em down on the farm after they seem tarry?
The San Diego City Council has unanimously approved an Urban Agricultural Incentive Zone, a program that will help expand community access to fresh produce through a property tax incentive for urban farming on vacant, blighted land. The new program will provide communities throughout the entire city an economic tool to incentivize the development of community gardens on eyesore properties and bring community gardens to neighborhoods where fresh produce is in short supply. The proposal was authorized by Councilman Scott Sherman. An urban agricultural incentive zone reduces the property tax of a participating parcel owner in exchange for at least a 5-year contract for use of the land for urban agriculture. Properties must be between a tenth of an acre and 3 acres, with the entire property dedicated for agriculture. The new measure is made possible by State Assembly Bill 551, enacted in 2013. Councilman Sherman issued a press release after the measure's passage, stating, "I appreciate the support of my council colleagues for approving my measure that will incentivize the development of urban agriculture in all San Diego neighborhoods, as well as give residents and property owners an additional tool to transform blighted property in their communities." Board of Supervisors Chairman Ron Roberts says that urban agriculture has the potential to expand economic opportunities and help fight against obesity and diabetes. He adds that he hopes to see other cities in the region follow suit, and he expects a similar incentive measure to come before the county supervisors in the next 3 months, KPBS reports. Eric Larson, executive director of the San Diego County Farm Bureau, concludes, "The new program will not only bring much-needed produce to communities in need, it will also help introduce the joy of farming to those who may have never had the opportunity to grow their own produce." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Rebecca Williamson.
And Leon Thompson, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And this is Leon Thompson,
guest hosting this week's Destination East County, which includes a night hike while stargazing at the Santa Isabel Preserve, a Pirate's Cove run walk at Lake Cuyamaca, live music in La Mesa, and the Julian Doves and Desperados performing Wild West skits in Julian.
Plus, we'll have previews of coming attractions, including St. Patrick's Day celebrations, egg hunts, garden tours, a desert art show, a backroom beer pairing, a harmonica festival, a spring carnival, Snoopy the Musical, a hike to the Valley of the Moon, and more. So stay tuned for all these and more.
Avast, a run walk at Pirate's Cove along the shores of Lake Cuyamaca, is set to begin on Friday, March 4th. This unique event includes both a 12-hour and a 24-hour option, with the 24-hour portion kicking off at 8 a.m. and a 12-hour all-night run walk starting off at 8 p.m., all entrants will receive swag with a Pirate's Cove logo. Winners will get Pirate Buckles awards, and you can also win a prize for the best pirate costume. For more information, you can visit sdpiratescove12-24.com.
Ranger Bill at the San Isabel West Preserve invites you to join him for a night hike and amateur astronomy this Saturday, March 5th. The planet Jupiter will be visible while it's closest to the Earth. You can view it through the County Park Service's new telescope or bring your own. Also bring a flashlight, comfortable shoes, and a jacket. The hike takes place from 5 until 9 p.m., departing from the Santa Isabel Preserve in Santa Isabel. For more information, call the park at 760-765-4098.
The Jennings Castle Duo will perform live music at the San Pasquale Winery Tasting Room on La Mesa Boulevard on March 5th from 7 to 10 p.m. The team features Les Jennings on saxophone and David Castell de Oro on keyboard, performing instrumental versions of jazz and pop music favorites. For more information, you can go to sanpasqualewinery.com.
The Julian Doves and Desperados will be performing historic comedy and gunfight skits in downtown Julian each Sunday this month at 1, 2, and 3 p.m. The shows take place next to the Julian Market and Deli and the Julian Fitness Center. Admission is free to the skits, which feature such colorful characters as Black Jack David, CeCe Chiquita, Captain Cooper, Sadie Cashman, Doc Hopkins, Snake, and Gypsy Davenport.
Now for a preview of coming attractions. Young Adult Theater will present Snoopy the Musical, featuring all of the Peanuts characters, including Charlie Brown, Lucy, Linus, and that mischief-making beagle, Snoopy. The shows will be performed at the Encore Theater in Spring Valley, with the junior cast on March 11th through 13th and the senior cast March 17th through 20th. For tickets and details, you can visit yatsandiego.org.
Lamplighters Community Theater will present the Tony Award nominee Mac and Mabel at the new Lamplighters Community Theater in La Mesa, March 11th through April 10th. Step back into yesteryear in this saga of the silent film era when movies were movies. Mac and Mabel deals with the complex relationship between legendary film director Mac Sennett, a temperamental workaholic, and the adorable Mabel Normand, a waitress who became one of his biggest stars. The story is told in flashback style by Mac, reminiscing about the past, his triumphs, his love affair with Mabel, and her rise to stardom before talkies made the silent film industry obsolete. For tickets, visit lamplighterslamesa.com.
The Hukumba Hikers and Walkers will be leading a trek to the Valley of the Moon, which may include Smuggler's Cave, an old hideout of bandits and smugglers off of I-8, just past the San Diego Imperial County line in a high desert area near the Mexican border. The hike will take place on March 12th with possible side trips to Elliott Mine and Blue Angels Peak Monument. This four-hour hike is rated hard, with a distance of about 7 to 8 miles round trip. You can meet at the Hukumba Spa starting at 8 a.m., and bring a swimsuit and towel to soak in the mineral hot spring.
Country music greats Larry Gatlin and the Gatlin Brothers will be performing in concert at Sequan's Live and Up Close Theater on Saturday, March 12th at 8 p.m. Grammy Award-winning Larry Gatlin has written hit songs for many famous musical stars, including Elvis Presley, Glen Campbell, and Johnny Cash. For tickets and more information, you can visit sequan.com.
Registration is now open for East County's St. Patrick's Day Half Marathon 5K Run Walk, Green Mile, and Tribes and Clans competition, which will be held this year on Saturday, March 12th, the weekend before St. Patrick's Day. This event aims to involve the entire family in fun and fitness. The Green Mile Fun Run, an enjoyable short-distance non-competitive event, is also available. The marathon features a finish line festival, health wellness fair, and craft beer invitational. Participants are encouraged to wear green and vie for prizes for best costumes. Funds raised will benefit several East County charities. This event is hosted by the Run East County Foundation. To register, volunteer, or get more information, you can visit stpatricksdayhalf.com.
More than 60 artists will exhibit their works at the Circle of Art Show in Borrego Springs on Saturday and Sunday, March 12th and 13th. The artists work in a variety of media, including fine arts, oils and watercolors, photography, sculpture, pottery and ceramics, jewelry, fabric art, and more. This two-day show includes music, food, and free admission. The event will be held in Christmas Tree Circle in the heart of Borrego Springs. For more information, you can visit circleofart.org.
You're invited to dust off your favorite green outfit to join Barron's Market in Alpine on Wednesday, March 16th for a St. Paddy's Day-themed beer and food tasting with San Diego brewer Modern Times. Barron's backroom beer pairings transform loading docks and stockrooms into food and local brew speakeasies. Friends and neighbors will gather at their neighborhood store to sample local beers paired with savory appetizers made from the market's selection of all-natural ingredients. For tickets and details, you can go to barronsmarket.com.
You're invited to bring the kids out to Lake Jennings' second annual Spring Carnival. The festivities will be on Saturday, March 19th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. and will include an egg hunt, face painting, paddle boarding, and a fully stocked kids' pond, plus 2,000 pounds of trout. To learn more or get directions, you can visit lakejennings.org.
It's garden tour time in the desert, and the 18th annual Borrego Springs Garden Tour invites visitors to experience private gardens and homes at their own pace on Saturday, March 19th. Attractions include Happy Days, the former home of James and Helen Copley at La Casa del Zorro Resort, plus five other gardens, several with open homes, located in beautiful Borrego Springs during the height of the spring bloom. For ticket sales and information, you can visit Borrego Desert Natural Center in Borrego Springs or go online at www.abdnha.org. That stands for the Anza Borrego Desert Natural History Association.
The Borona Cultural Museum is offering classes on Native American culture and crafts, including a Native foods cooking class, Cooking with the Yucca Plant, on March 12th, and more. All classes are from 10:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. The Borona Cultural Center and Museum is located on the Borona Indian Reservation in Lakeside. For more information, you can go to boronamuseum.org.
You're invited to the 16th Annual Spring Harp Fest, a musical celebration on March 26th from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. at Harry Griffin Park in La Mesa. The festival features top harmonica performers playing blues music and more, as well as an unknown artist's jam session. The mission is to inspire appreciation for the harmonica in the next generation. While admission is free, donations are welcome and used to provide gifts of harmonicas to local school music programs. For a full lineup of talent slated to perform, you can check out springharpfest.org.
Santee Lakes invites you to bring the kids for an annual extravaganza on Saturday, March 26th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. This fun-filled event features continuous egg hunts, live entertainment, a petting zoo, craft booths, and carnival rides, all hosted by the Padre Dam Municipal Water District and the City of Santee. Admission is free, though there are small fees for rides and parking. You can learn more at SanteeLakes.com.
The Water Conservation Garden invites the public to its first annual WaterWise Home Garden Tour on Saturday, March 26th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. The self-guided tour will highlight a variety of beautiful gardens located in El Cajon, La Mesa, and Rancho San Diego, using an array of color, variety, and low water usage. Learn about using native succulents, cacti, and Mediterranean plants, plus how you can design your yard for low water use plants. The gardens emphasize plants from semi-arid regions of the world, and succulent cuttings for many of the home tours will be on sale, as well as other garden and home items. The garden's director of horticulture will be available to talk about redesigning your landscape with low water usage plants. For tickets, you can visit thegarden.org.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all these events and more on our calendar and in our festivals and events section online at eastcountymagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website, or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
This is Liz Alper with a sports report for East County Magazine here on KNSJ. After a slow start to the season, the San Diego State men's basketball team is now mirroring the dominant season the football program had in conference play, clinching the Mountain West title on Wednesday night with a 73-61 win over Wyoming. The win was SDSU's 14th in conference play and 21st overall. The win was also revenge. Wyoming defeated SDSU in last year's conference tournament championship game. The Aztecs have a 4-game lead in the conference. This is the 5th Mountain West conference title in 6 years and 10th overall under head coach Steve Fisher.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And this is Leon Thompson. Today we're on the road in Julian, California, a historic gold rush town in the mountains of East County, San Diego.
Now back in 1870, the town was founded by Drury Bailey and his cousin, Mike Julian. The two cousins were Confederate soldiers during the Civil War, both taken prisoner by the Yankees. After they got out and the war ended, they found their homeland had been laid waste by General Sherman's march to the sea, so they and other family members decided to head west. But Drury missed the boat to Panama, so he went overland instead. He did some hard rock mining in Montana, but then he ran out of money. So he flagged down a wagon train, and by a fortunate stroke of fate, he found that his brother was the driver. Drury founded the town of Julian in 1870 and named it after his cousin, Michael Julian. Traumatized by the war, Drury wanted to help others start new lives. So he gave away plots of land to anyone who agreed to build a home right away, as well as giving plots away for a school, a church, a jail, a town hall, and a chamber of commerce. Now, it wasn't hard to convince people to move to this remote mountain town, since that same year, Julian resident Fred Coleman reportedly paused to give his mule some water and discovered gold in what is now known as Coleman Creek, and the Julian Gold Rush was on.
Today, we've brought along our team of interns to tell you about the hidden treasures in this town of Julian, California, where you can relive the gold rush days nearly a century and a half ago.
Hello, this is Trevor Hill, and I'm here with historian David Lewis. Thank you for being here, David.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So I'm just going to ask you a few questions about Julian. First, I wanted to know, who were the people who founded the town?
Basically, Dury Bailey and Mike Julian were the only people who were really involved in the town. Dury had homesteaded all this land, and then in 1870, when the major hard rock mines were discovered, that's when he hired a surveyor to lay out the town. So that's when I say it started, was February of 1870.
Who was Fred Coleman?
Fred Coleman is a black man that was in the area way before Julian was founded. We have him on San Diego County tax rolls in 1863, which is kind of interesting. That's when two the major battles of the Civil War took place. So it's right in the middle of the Civil War. So what's Fred doing here at that time period is interesting by itself. We don't have any answers to that. We probably never will. But Fred, he was apparently, according to local lore, had cattle here. He was friendly with the local Indians. We know that because he eventually married an Indian woman, Maria Jesus Anejo. Fred was apparently out looking after his cattle and stopped to water his horse in a creek. Again, this is local lore. They really expand on it sometimes, telling that he took his frying pan out of his saddle bags and all this, but we don't know any of this. We just know that Fred was the guy that discovered the gold. Apparently, Fred couldn't keep a secret because pretty quick there were a bunch of people panning in that creek. And that was placer gold, the can you do pan for in water in a creek. But it didn't last very long. And so then they started working their way up the creek to find the source of the gold. And that's when they found it in these hills north of town.
And how did the discovery of that gold change Julian?
Well, Julian didn't even exist when that gold was discovered. So that was like the launch point for everything that happened around here. When word got back that they had found successful mine workings up here, and the first loads of ore ended up downtown on display and taken up to San Francisco for milling and assaying, that launched Julian.
Wow. Do you have any colorful stories that you've heard about the gold rush or just Julian in general?
There's lots of colorful stories, but I'm the historian for the cemetery too, and people always ask me who the most interesting person from Julian that's buried in that cemetery, and it's Dury Bailey, the man that founded this town. Because when he founded this town, he went and he fought in the Civil War right after he got out of high school. Terrible deal. The family lost all of their land back there, and they end up here. And Dury homesteads all this land, and then, like I say, gets that surveyor. Dury's 26 years old when he did this. I find that pretty amazing because I was still looking for some gas for my car and hoping for a date when I was 26 years old. And this man starts a town. He made a pretty good reputation for himself as being a generous person, but he also had a lot of foresight.
Interesting. Can you tell us about this building that we're in right now, the Pioneer History Museum?
This building started out life. It was built by Joseph Treschel, who was a blacksmith, and he ran it for a few years. This was in the 1890s. And then he sold it, or leased it, I'm not sure which, to Peter Meyerhofer, who brewed beer here. And then it went back to another blacksmith, Christian Grosskopf, who blacksmithed here, and that was the last thing that I know that happened in here. It fell to ruin. All that was left are these rock walls in here. Wow. And in 1952, the Women's Club took it upon themselves to get some county money and some volunteers, and they rebuilt what you see here.
Wow.
So there's been a little expansion out the front, and we're doing a little expansion out the south end right now. But
So these are the original stone walls that we're seeing around
those
this?
Right there, yes. And wow. Those were probably mined right here on site. That's Julian Schist. S-C-H-I-S-T, just to clarify that. Anyway, that is what is unique to this Julian area, and it's the quartz within that schist where the gold is found. So when they flattened this area out, they were cutting that stuff off, and it comes off in slabs because it's sedimentary,
mm-hmm.
and and it's hard, mm-hmm. and then it's stackable. That's how these walls came about, was right from what was here.
Wow.
How often can you do that anymore?
Do you have any favorite exhibits here at the museum?
Well, probably my favorite is the Bailey exhibit, because I almost feel like family. I know as much or probably more than a lot of the family does about them, because that's been my focus. It has a few personal things in there, but my favorite one is that pick that's exhibited in there. It's not necessarily a pick that you would use for mining ore. It's for picking out samples. And he was injured in the mine in 1899, disappeared from the logbook for a while on the payroll. Mm-hmm. And when he came back, he had fashioned that pick as a cane also.
Wow.
So it's a little short, you might know. And
hit a hunch, maybe.
not Drury. Drury, this is the giant founder of the town, is 5'3" tall. So I've got a little picture that I did once. I photoshopped him in, me and my documentation, right? I photoshopped him in next to me and put a ruler between us, mm-hmm. just to show the difference of what we look like.
Wow. Thank you so much for answering my questions.
You're very welcome.
Anyone can come here and talk to David on Sundays you're here?
I'm usually here off and on. Okay. Lately, I've been able to get Drury's grandson, Richard Bailey. Anybody that comes up here can talk to the grandson of the founder of the town.
I have one more question. When did the mine close?
All in varying stages. There was no real just shutdown. People kept piddling around. Mm-hmm. They're still out there piddling around.
Wow, really?
Yeah. You know, especially when times get hard. People mm-hmm. are out there trying to get lucky. But say from 1900, they were pretty much done. But then my grandfather's draft record shows he was a hoist operator at the Golden Chariot, and that would have been about 1918. Now we mine tourists.
Well, okay. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
Up next, we're going to have Jaden Jimenez tell us about what he found most interesting about the museum here.
While I was looking through the museum, one of the more interesting things that I found was a railroad spring. It was on a railroad cart. And what they did is they got the spring and put it in the Victorian Town Hall here in Julian. And basically, it was for the dance floor. So when there was large groups of people, they would dance and it would actually really add a springy effect. So I thought that was pretty interesting. One of the only spring floors left is actually in the Hotel del Coronado.
Wow, that's so interesting. Thank you, Dayton.
What do you think, guys? How would you like to go try your hand at some gold mining?
I'm feeling lucky.
All right, let's go.
This is Devon Marshall, and we're here at the Eagle Mine in Julian, which is open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to mid to late afternoon or so if you want to tour the mine or try your hand at panning for gold. Now I'm going to be talking to Mr. Craig Nelson, whose family owns and operates the mines, and with Kim Gordon, one of our guys today.
My grandpa, he ran this from about the late 60s all the way till he passed away. Then my dad took over, and then he passed away about 10 years ago. And then me and my brothers that took over, and we're really blessed to have a grandpa that decided not to dig the gold out of the mountain, because that's a lot harder of a job. Taking you folks through that mountain and teaching the history is a lot fun.
So then the real goal is the tourism.
Well, the education.
Okay.
I'll tell you, because the tourists that come to Julian, California, and I always, I'll tell you, the local town museum down there, which is Mr. Lewis, right. And those folks, and we just did Kim did a nice seminar down here at the library the other night, and you know, a lot of the kids don't realize what it takes to gold mine back in the 1870s and how they just barely made a living with this type of method. And they all want keyboards and phones and, you know, the technology of today. They don't pick up the pick and shovel and right. you know, do 8, 10, 12-hour shifts under hard rock mining. And that's what we want to show you is it's hard to get a guy to do that kind of work anymore.
So Steven, one of our interns, is here, and he's going to try his hand at some of the panning for gold. Can you come over and give him a couple pointers on how to do this?
You want the sand to go over the rigid. That's why they make the tools. It's black to keep the metals separated. You can see the colors.
Uh-huh.
So like you said, you scrape to the bottom. And what I do, once you get it in a pan, I settle it, shake it. Because then you get control of the sand by settling the gold to the bottom of the pan. Then when you get to the gold to the bottom of the pan, you simply let the pan and the water do the work for you, because that's what it's made to do. But you know what the first gold pan used to be back in 1800? The gold horn. We got a gold horn in there, so what they did is cut the end of the horns off. It's a U shape, right? You scrape it down into the stream, and you rock it back and forth. The gold being heavy stays in the metal. Unfortunately, I'm not going to go cut some horn off of a steer or something like that and get the end of the horn. Take this pan, and then once you settle the gold and you're happy with it, then you just let the water in the pan wash the sand out because the gold's heavier and it goes to the bottom.
Okay, so we have Stevan over here who's been trying his hand at it. Stevan,
what's his yield?
Come tell us how it's going.
It's been going good. I found myself a lot of gold, and the techniques by Kim,
our favorite tour guide, one of our friends and family.
It actually works.
Yeah, ooh, look
now,
at all that.
What you want to do is concentrate. We want to see what you got as a collector. Get it all to the end of the pan, concentrate it by tapping it. Keep water in the pan. And then it separates, just like up at the mill. The sand will always go first, and the gold, being the heaviest, will drag out of the back with the black, that's the iron, separates by the metal like the mill up there. And you tap it, and you start rolling it. And the gold being heavier, we're going to chase the gold tail, as they call it. And look at how it comes and drags out the back. So now doesn't that look prettier? The way that you could look at it like that.
Eureka!
Eureka! You're both trying. So that's what you get. That's about $10, $12 worth of a gold tail right there. Now we're going to start at the Eagle Adit, because instead of an entrance to gold mine, they call them adits. A-D-I-T is a question puzzle.
What could we expect when we go down to do the mine tour?
Well, what we're going to expect is we're going to go over to the entrance, and we're going to learn how do you know where to start your tunnel? Because they couldn't pan for gold with the streams drying up. So we're going to go over the mountain. We're going to look at the way that the layers and the mountain structured. And we're going to show you how they go into the mountain and abstract the gold-bearing ore, the quartz, out of the mountain. You just learned how to get the gold out of the quartz by the California 5 stand mill. Now remember, that machine would operate right on that foundation right there. And we moved it up there when my grandpa made this a tour business. That way you had two-stage tour area right there. And once you move 22 tons, you don't move it back as you go. So we're going to show you how they go through that mountain and pull out the gold-bearing ore, and you already seen how to process it. So let's go see how we can get that quartz, the gold-bearing ore, out of the mountain.
Okay, we can send our interns down into the mine. You guys ready?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
We're going to cover...
Bye.
Yeah. Well, it's nice knowing you. We'll see you in about 50 years of being abandoned on the mountain. Okay.
This is Leon, and we're down in Julian, California, and our interns are back. How did it go on the mine shaft?
Oh, well, it was really great. We got to learn a lot of stuff, and it was really interesting, you know, learning the history. One of the coolest things that I thought that happened while we were in the mine is while we were in, you know, all the lights are on, you can see, you know, decently well, but he took us to this room where there was a candle, and he turned off all the lights, all of the lights to light up the mine, and it was complete darkness. There's no light source coming in whatsoever. And so we lit the candle so we could see how, you know, the old miners used to see just such dim light, and they had to deal with this for 10 hours a day. And so, yeah.
My favorite part of the mine tour was seeing all the gadgets that the miners used back then. And one gadget in particular was the Widowmaker, which was a nomadic drill. It was created to carve deeper into the cave. The nomadic drill would drill into the rocks, and then they would put dynamite in the holes, and the dynamite would explode, causing a lot of dust to affect the lungs of the miners, causing them to have lung cancer. And that's why they call it the Widowmaker.
Well, my favorite part of the tour was we got to this point in the mine where there was a shaft that went straight down for 425 feet, and our tour guide showed us the bucket that they used to pull ore up from the mine, and it turns out that they also used it as an elevator. And there was this huge steam-powered machine that cranked the rope because it's such a long drop, you can't really have people trusted to hoist someone up that far. And there was a bell on the machine that was so loud, and it was to give signals. Different amounts of rings meant different things. And it was so loud, and it echoed throughout the entire mine, and I just thought it was really cool.
So what do you think? So how would you guys have liked to make your living as a hard rock miner?
I'll leave that to the old-timey miner people.
Tough work, huh? Well, I bet you guys have worked up an appetite.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, walking all over town, going down the mine. All right, well, let's go find something wonderful to eat. And there's no shortage of great places to eat up here in Julian.
Especially if you're looking for apple pie. Because Julian's goal these days is the tourists that come here to enjoy this wonderful town. Let's go eat!
This is Jaden Jimenez with East County Magazine, and I'm here with Charles Scott. He works at Candied Apples and here in Julian, so can you tell us a little bit about history about Candied Apples in Julian?
You bet. Yes. My name's Charles. I'm the pastry chef and owner of the Candied Apple Pastry Company in Julian. We've been here for 11 years. Julian's kind of got a very interesting history with apples. It started with the gold miners who settled in this community in the late 1800s. They found that they could grow apples very easy here. In the early 1900s, they sent a bushel of apples to one of the world expos and won a gold medal. And that put Julian on the map for apples. Of course, supply and economics changed the world of apples up here a little bit. As Julian grew, some of the apple farms were turned into housing developments, wineries, and of course some of the apple growers retired. But there's still quite a lot of apples being grown up here, from a range of apple cider apples to you-pick apples to organic apples.
And apple pies.
And apple pie. Yeah, the apple pie history actually goes back probably to the Farmer family. Bud Farmer was an apple grower up here, and his wife used to make apple pies. This is dating back probably 40 years. As they handed off the business, Liz Smothers from the Julian Pie Company and Anita Knowles from Mom's took that over and kept the apple pie business alive up here in Julian and have kept that name quite alive. Of course, the Julian Pie Company, that works very well. Our little bakery is a European bakery and bistro concept. Of course, being in Julian, you have to make apple pie, so we do make apple pie.
Yeah,
along with many other things, like 12 kinds of breads. I have a 7-year-old sourdough starter started in the French way from a white wine yeast. We do pastries, desserts, wedding cakes, catering, full-service lunch menu, and, of course, French crepes.
Wow. How did you get started with this store?
With this store? Well, this store was a transition from 35 years of hard work. I started in the industry as a young boy doing dishes, got promoted to cooking because I said I didn't want to do dishes anymore, worked my way through the industry, some fine hotels, did my formal training in New York at the International Pastry Arts Center, ended up in Borrego Springs as the executive chef of a hotel there, and in there at La Casa del Zorro. And in the process of them closing down and selling out, this bakery was on the market, and I chose to buy it 8 years ago.
Wow, that's wonderful.
And it's been 8 years of quite the wild ride of producing delicious desserts, pastries, breads, wedding cakes, birthday cakes.
So can you tell us a little bit about the community here? I know earlier you were talking about how so many people come in.
Julian's, I mean, it's like I said, it's got a very diverse history. Today, Julian has really put itself on the map as a tourist community. Anybody who comes to San Diego, is part of the program is to see Julian, hear the history of Julian. I've met people from all parts of the world, the Far East, the Mideast, quite a few European travelers, Sweden, Germany, Italian, and of course America. I mean, I've met people from all over the world who come in the bakery here. It's very fun.
Wow, that sounds really interesting. Thank you for interviewing with us. This was great. We're going to enjoy this delicious lunch. Got a few sandwiches and crepes. A
couple of paninis and some crepes, you bet. Thank you for joining us.
Candied apples, we're looking forward to trying those.
For dessert. There we go. You got to save room for dessert. Life is uncertain. Save room for dessert.
Thank you.
So we'll be back soon with another edition of On the Road in East County. We're signing off from Julian, California.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.